Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Andrew Harrison. It's 11 o'clock on Saturday night in the UK, which means it's 7 a.m. in Tokyo on the final day of the 2020 Olympics. And with me, up bright and early, on his clock at least, to give us his take on this most extraordinary and unusual Olympics is Murad Ahmed, sports editor of the Financial Times. Good morning, Murad. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm all right, you know, still be swept along, sporting action and that kind of thing.
Exactly, bleary-eyed. That's what an Olympics does to us.
Exactly, yes, bleary-eyed at either side of the world. So thanks for getting up so early for us. Has this been your routine throughout the games, by the way? What are Japanese breakfasts like?
Well, because we're in the Olympics bubble, I haven't had an Olympics breakfast yet. I've been very much in the hotel buffet where I'm given a pair of plastic gloves to pick up a tray to go on the most hygienic buffet possible. And that's kind of been the experience of the Olympics. We've been cut off from the rest of Tokyo almost throughout. And it doesn't feel like the city is living the Olympics experience at all, and neither do the thousands of delegates and media and everybody else who has actually got to see it live.
Well, there are 6,000 journalists alone attending the Tokyo Games, and as you say, you've been kind of, you know, bubbled away from Tokyo. How has it compared to previous games that you've attended, and you know, both in terms of atmosphere and in terms of, you know, what you've had to work with as a journalist?
Well, I've been to two Olympics as a spectator, and this is my second Olympics as a reporter, and this is, like you were saying, the strangest, weirdest Olympics I've ever covered. There is no atmosphere. It's very strange being inside stadiums, and some of these stadiums are absolutely beautiful. The Olympic stadium that's been built in the middle of Tokyo, replacing the old National Stadium that was built for the 1964 Olympics here, is this kind of beautiful wooden structure, but you can hear the sound of cicadas, Tokyo's kind of everlasting sound, essentially, yeah, in the background while these great moments of sports are happening. And you do feel a sense of almost survivor's guilt for it, because we've been flown by our organizations at great expense, but everything has been put on here by essentially the Japanese and the Japanese people and the Japanese taxpayer. And they have gotten... The thing that they were promised was an ability to enjoy it, and they haven't had that. That's constantly felt wrong throughout, I have to say. So even though the sport has been fantastic, that overhanging sense that the pandemic has taken away from what is an Olympic atmosphere has always been with us throughout.
As a sports journalist, have you at least been able to think, well, perhaps we can concentrate on the actual sporting activity almost at a forensic level now without, you know, being distracted by the roar of the crowd? I mean, quite a Japanese thing, you know, to choose stillness and calm and quiet.
Well, I have to say no, only because, you know, we're just so used to, you know, operating with great noise. But I just think if the Olympics is anything that we can all relate to, is the sense of the world coming together. But it is also the sense of the world going somewhere to do that. And it is impossible to get away from the lack of crowds and some of the sights you see. I mean, one of the most heartbreaking things I saw was you get ushered into buses the whole time, which take you from venue to venue. That you can't go. In the first 14 days we were here, you could not leave this bubble. And people would line up outside the barriers to stadiums and wave at you as you were going past, because they saw this official bus and they thought you were an athlete of some sort. So I had a tiny Japanese child, no older than my daughter, at home, looking up at the bus and waving at me. And I just thought, this is wrong. This is really wrong. I have to say, the thing I told my editors before we got here is the story that would dominate in the lead up is COVID. Of course it will. But I always said that once it got going, we would want stories about the sport itself. And that is exactly how it's played out. The sport has been fantastic. And we've seen that throughout the pandemic, when football and everything else has got going again, people do get distracted by what's on the pitch. But that sense of loss is not going to go away.
We're recording this for you at the start of the final day of competition. Team GB look likely to finish in fifth place with between 64, maybe 67 medals if they get lucky today, including 20 golds. The initial target was between 45 and 70 medals. They're probably not going to beat the record of 67 from Rio. How do you think Britain is going to look back on this Games as a project from a sporting perspective in terms of achievement and progress?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, I always, and I've been writing into copy, that they haven't set a medals target this time, not a proper one, as they have in previous years. And that's partly to do with the sense that setting that medals target, which was linked to funding of sports, was putting undue pressure on athletes, and there have been a number of bullying scandals across a number of Olympic sports that related essentially to coaches feeling like they were under incredible pressure to that they relayed onto athletes to secure money and jobs and things like that. This is the stuff that people don't want to hear when they're listening to the kind of the BBC commentary and the kind of cheerleading that goes on. I have to say, I'm incredibly grateful not to be watching it because I find it incredibly, incredibly parochial that we are, from my understanding, we were obsessing with modern pentathlon for the last couple of days, which seems like an odd way of covering the world's greatest sporting event. So from a British perspective, look, what has happened over the last few Olympic Games is a ruthless targeting of medals. Money spent on dozens, I think in the run-up to Tokyo, around £350 million of taxpayer money and national lottery proceeds, more money than has ever been spent on Olympic sports, on a few dozen medal hopefuls, which has gone into collecting, like you're saying, 60 odd medals. And if that makes you feel proud, that's great. I personally think that it's an odd way of spending money. I think this obsession with Team GB is slightly strange, given up that I grew up watching the Olympics in an era where, you know, one gold medal in Atlanta was obviously terrible to watch from a home perspective, but it meant that you did focus on all the other stuff that was going on. So Great Britain is an Olympic superpower. It's very clear that's the case. Whenever you turn up to anything, there's always a British athlete in and around a chance for a medal, and usually in the ones I've seen getting medals. There have been I think there have been some really great moments for the Brits and slightly more unexpected ones. I went to the BMX racing, where Bethany Shriver and Kai White won medals. I don't think those were completely expected. Britain have spent a lot of money on cycling, but BMX was the last discipline that Britain hadn't won a gold medal. And those I felt genuinely were uplifting, and I couldn't help but punch the air a little bit then. But I think we're starting to see some of this power even out. That Britain had a poor regatta in rowing, in the velodrome, which they've completely dominated. It seemed like other countries had caught up, technologically at least. So I think we are all going to have a conversation with ourselves. Are we going to continue with this in this vein of pumping so much money into the very top level of Olympics sports, because every 4 years or 5 years in this case, we want to have a party and watch the BBC relentlessly and check on the medal count?
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming more and more widely said that Britain has, you know, great medal performance in the Olympics and terrible participation in sports in the country at large, that we're kind of putting all of our resources into, as you say, tens and indeed hundreds of millions of pounds of funding into elite sports. Do you think there's likely to be consequences, say, for rowing after, you know, they just had their worst games in 49 years? Are they likely to see funding withdrawn?
That's really difficult to say, because if you take the kind of the British Olympic authorities at their word, they have said we are moving in a different direction. We are less focused on the medal count. We are more focused on athlete welfare. And squaring that circle means you've got to keep funding sports which are traditional British strengths, and allow a different culture to build up within those sports, which is what, you know, is being said by people like Andy Anderson, who's the British Olympic Association's chief executive. But if we still think that we're going to pump in quite so much money in the search of glory at an Olympic Games, then you still have to target some of these sports where there are just a lot of medals available. There are a lot of rowing medals available. There are a lot of cycling medals available. So you do have to end up concentrating your money towards a handful even of Olympic sports in the hope of a kind of racking up a good medal count. If you still want that as a goal, I can't see rowing, sailing and cycling getting any less money into the future. It is actually a kind of a top-down decision. You know, it's a kind of quasi-government body and the government who make those decisions. And so it's kind of up to Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson to decide that it's worth the cash. I mean, we weren't sure that Tokyo. I remember covering this. We weren't sure that Tokyo was going to get the funding that we for the British team that it did. But George Osborne made a let's say patriotic decision to push cash towards the British team. So. I guess we'll see, but I do think the only way to see how the medal count plays out is really how much cash gets sent to these Olympic sports.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Murad, you mentioned athlete welfare, and one of the standout stories was obviously Simone Biles pulling out of most of her events to focus on her mental health. Around the same time, elsewhere in sport, you know, swimmer Adam Peaty, creator Ben Stokes have also withdrawn from events. Around Simone Biles, we had the really unpleasant spectacle of armchair social media fans berating her for not having what it takes. You know, people who are literally sitting on their armchairs, tapping away on their iPads. Do you think that this Games is going to have consequences, positive consequences for the understanding of mental health in sport?
Yeah, I thought it was the biggest moment of the Games. I was in the gymnastics arena when that happened. You know, I was sitting next to a colleague ready to explain the brilliance of Simone Biles, because I've followed her in Rio, and I was very much, I've been writing about it in the lead up to that event, and something was very, very clearly wrong. She gave an extraordinary, it wasn't quite a press conference, it's basically the media scrum afterwards, where she explained everything. And actually what she was describing about wasn't strict, it wasn't mental health in the way that the discussion has kind of expanded from there. And I think that's where some of the disconnect and some of the kind of social media warriors who've gone after her have not quite understood. She was talking about something incredibly specific. She called it the twisties, which is a gymnastics term, where her mind and body were no longer connecting. She was no longer aware of where she was when she's spinning in the air. And she took herself out with great self-awareness and grace, I thought, of the firing line, because she couldn't be sure that she would land on her feet, and that's what gone on. And this is and what was really interesting is that if you ignored, I'm not even going to mention the names of these idiots who are going after her, because none of them were sports people, it seemed to me, but if you followed gymnasts on Twitter, they were all sharing their stories of this particular phenomenon, and they were saying, you know, it lasts one or two weeks. And they were sharing videos of them kind of falling flat on their faces on you know, soft mats rather than on a hard floor in Olympic Stadium. So I think it was really important for the wider public to understand that these performers are humans and not machines, and performance issues can crop up and derail even the greatest. I don't think so. Anybody will deny, really, anyone who understands sport, that Simone Biles remains the greatest gymnast of all time. But I think we are starting to have a much better understanding that these are human beings who can be affected by other things away from sport.
Yeah. I mean, other standout stories, but perhaps more encouraging, more positive, is that people were able to, you know, sort of, you know, to take stands at this Olympics in a way that we haven't often seen lately. Tom Daley used his press conference to send a message of support for young LGBT people. The US shot putter Raven Saunders performed a quite powerful protest on the podium after winning a silver medal. You know, despite the IOC's best efforts, protest and politics to actually manage to get in and onto the agenda this time. Do you think, why does the IOC find it so difficult to accept that this is kind of intrinsic to sport now, that sport is about taking a stand as well as performing?
So I spoke to Thomas Bach, the president of the International Olympic Committee, before the game started, and this was the main topic that we had. And he made a point of saying that he didn't want to see protests on the podium. So the IOC relaxed a load of rules around freedom of speech for athletes, essentially. You know, you can say what you want on social media, in press conferences, you can, but they didn't want it to happen on the podium or the field of play. Privately, other people within the IOC said they have no way of enforcing this. So as the cases that you've brought up have happened, and there hasn't been pushback really from the IOC, but they don't want it because they see themselves as you know, genuinely global and supposedly part of the sport. And what they really worry about is less of a case of Raven Saunders and more a case of, you know, two countries that are on the edge of war and somebody stands on the podium and makes a political gesture which kind of sparks something much bigger, and that's the kind of weird mindset they get into, and they really struggle when there are causes which, even within the IOC, they want to support things like equality on sexual orientation and anti-racism stances. These are things that they quietly would like to support, but feel like they can't. It's a very odd organization. It's odd that they have to inflict these things on everyone else. But I've also enjoyed the fact that athletes feel like they can have a voice and say what they want. They will continue to be attacked because that's the kind of the world that we live in. But at least they have the platform to do those things.
So what did you make of the Belarusian sprinter Kristina Tymanovskaya refusing orders to fly home from the Olympics? She's now in Poland on a humanitarian visa, having effectively, you know, fled the Belarusian Olympic team. I mean, that was the political furore of the Games, wasn't it?
It was, and I can remember that one distinctly as well, because that story broke just after an astonishing men's 100 meter final, when a random Italian came from nowhere to win to win the marquee race of any Olympics. But shortly after that, you know, I start getting messages popping up on my phone saying you need to investigate the whereabouts of a Belarusian sprinter. I think this is one of the cases where it shows how the IOC is in a really difficult position when it comes to politics and sport. Simonskaya is among the athletes who have complained of the situation in Belarus. And what had happened prior to the games is Alexander Lukashenko, the kind of dictatorial leader of Belarus, after a fraudulent election in that a presidential election in that country, had a crackdown on all dissent, including including athletes. Athletes had complained in the country of imprisonment and harassment. The IOC had banned Lukashenko from coming to these Olympics and a load of officials because of these cases. So there was form leading up to the Olympic Games. Simonskaya had complained about her coaches basically claiming incompetence on their part. She's a sprinter in the 100 and 200 meters. She had been inserted at the last minute into the 4x400 meter relay, something that she's no expertise at, because other athletes had not done enough of the doping test required to come to the games. So suddenly she was kind of thrown into the mix of something that she was uncomfortable with. She complained. It appears as though she was told to go home. She was scared. It took the IOC days to really start a formal investigation, although they did appear to kick out the two coaches that were involved in this case. And it just shows you that the Olympics does become a place where national issues get highlighted in a way that you can't anywhere. And it is the world watching. And Simonskaya really, you know, she gave a press conference in Poland on arriving, and she told her fellow compatriots, you know, you shouldn't be afraid to speak up. And that is the power of the Olympics platform. The world's media really cared about what she was saying in a way that they wouldn't have in any other situation. But I'm glad she's safe. I understand that, you know, it's her family now that she's worried about, and hopefully these stories don't disappear once the kind of the circus and the roadshow moves on.
Yeah. Just before we wrap up, one of the weirder sights in the games was the Russian Olympic Committee, or not Russia.
Yes.
Has Russia successfully made fools of the IOC's doping regime then by just going out under a different name?
Depends if you think there's a doping regime within the Olympics. if you think that what you've been watching is clean sport, you have not been watching the history of the Olympics, and that goes way beyond Russia. But on the Russia particular case, so there have been revelations of this state-sponsored doping regime that came out in 2015, which Russia have always denied, but have been independently verified by multiple different agencies now. And the fallout from that in 2019 was that another ban was introduced for these games and the next games in Winter Games in Beijing, which is related to the manipulation of data. Essentially, they were still messing with the anti-doping data even after all this time. So the ban meant that the symbols of the Russian state couldn't appear at the game. So that meant no flag, no anthem. The interpretation of the ban by the IOC has been, let's say, minimal. The uniforms have featured the colors of the Russian flag. The flag that is shown when Russians do win is a flame in the Russian colors on top of the Olympic rings. The music that was agreed to be played is Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. Like you say, the team is called the Russian Olympic Committee. Vladimir Putin has been sending congratulatory telegrams to all Russian Olympic champions. In reality, what I think this is that very tepid end of a fight that has been going on for years between Russia and global sports authorities. No one is willing to continue this fight any longer in a way that is meaningful. And that's what's played out here. It does, I think it tells you very much that the Russian tactics on this have worked. They fought a rear guard where they've denied that there's been any problem and managed to maintain their place within global sports. And what it means for clean sport is that, you know, like I say, anyone watching can take with a relative pinch of salt that anti-doping authorities will be able to either keep sport clean or enforce strong punishments when there are clear cases of doping going on.
I seem to remember that it's traditional for the IOC to describe every games as the best ever, with very few exceptions. And mm-hmm. Through no fault of the Japanese, who've obviously been dealt a terrible hand here, is that going to be possible this time?
They've been trying. I mean, Thomas Bach gave an incredibly tone-deaf press conference towards the end of these games, saying that it's barely been noticeable. You know, the sport has been so great, it's barely been noticeable that there's no spectators. I don't think anyone can go away and say these have been the greatest games because of the circumstances that they've been held in. I think it is incredibly sad that the Japanese have put on this event without the ability to really share in it. We've seen some really awful sights from my perspective. The kind of the urban sports park where a lot of the new sports like skateboarding and BMX freestyle have been takes place where there's a bridge that can overlook it, and the bridge has been absolutely packed of people in the midday sun trying to get a glimpse of the action, shut out of it entirely. The other thing is, like, polls say that the general mood in the country is against the Olympics and has been throughout, and that Japanese success in the medal count, we don't actually know if that's helped. But I think this has definitely been the weirdest games. It's been memorable, and I will go away with a huge amount of stories as a result of it. But I think it's not at all what the Olympics games were at its best is supposed to be.
Just to finish off then, what has been amidst all the weirdness and all the disappointment and the sadness for the Japanese who wanted it to be an amazing game, what has been your favourite moment of the sport that you've seen?
Of the sport itself, I was in the stadium when Carsten Warholm, Norwegian runner, won the 400-meter hurdles in absolutely blazing conditions where, of the eight runners, the first three all went inside the existing world record. Six of the runners broke national records. It was astonishing to watch them kind of power over the line. He ripped open his shirt on the finish line. That is what you want to, that's the sort of experience that you want to have. They came down to talk to the media afterwards and trash talked each other and complimented each other in equal measure. It was fantastic, fantastic rivalry, incredible sport. That one really stood out to me as the thing that I'll take away forever and think, well, I really watched one of the greatest races in Olympic history. Throughout, there were moments like that of sporting transcendence, which you can't avoid because these people have been really have been training for 5 years and completely dedicated their lives. The one thing I would say about being in completely empty stadiums watching this is that you can't miss the full focus is on the athletes, and you don't miss those moments. It isn't drowned out by the sound. You absolutely see the raw emotion. You see these people collapse on the finish line, what they actually go through, and you hear it live. And all of that has been an incredible privilege.
Amazing, but let's not do it again like this.
Let's hope so. But I know that the French are out here shadowing the Japanese before the Paris Games, and they are sort of planning for some sort of, there will be restrictions, they think, for for many years to come. So let's not, but I'm not necessarily sure that the world we're currently living is going to disappear just yet.
Murad Ahmed, thank you for getting up early to talk to us. What's in your final day?
I've either got women's volleyball final or buying souvenirs for family. I haven't quite decided which I'll do. But I do have to write a piece now summing up the game, so this has been useful.
Oh, good. Well, you heard it here first then. Fantastic. Murad, thank you so much. It's always good to get your insight and absolutely fascinating, and hope you enjoy your last day in Japan. Listeners, thank you for listening. Don't forget, you can fund our grassroots program in the growing sport of podcasting. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out how to support us and keep us going in the marathon that entails getting you a new podcast every morning. Murad's off to look for souvenirs around Tokyo. I'm off to bed. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The Bunker Daily was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronovich, and the Bunker theme tune is by Kenny Dickinson. Audio production was from me, Robin Leeburn, and The Bunker is a Podmasters production.